If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. In 1823, the enslaved people living on the sugar plantations of the British colony of Demerara, now Guyana, decided to launch an uprising. It's a story that Thomas Harding brings to life in his new book, White Debt, telling the tale through the eyes of four people involved: a slave owner, a white missionary, a leader of the uprising, and a member of the white militia that sought to quash it. I spoke to Thomas about the uprising and its far-reaching consequences. Your book recounts an uprising by enslaved people in the British colony of Demerara in 1823. So before we delve into what happened that year, what do we need to know about Demerara in the early 19th century? Because I think a lot of listeners might not even know where or what Demerara is.
So when I started looking at this story, I had no idea where Demerara was. I mean, I knew about the sugar, which I put in my tea sometimes. But it turns out that Demerara is the country now we call Guyana, which is in South America, the only English-speaking country in South America. It's just to the east of Venezuela, just the north of Brazil, and its northern edge is on the Atlantic coast. And it considers itself part of the Caribbean, even though it's part of South America. And until the beginning of the 19th century, Demerara was disputed territory. So the French, the British, and the Dutch, they exchanged ownership of the colony. But by the time we get to the 1820s, Britain is very much in control. It has been agreed that it is a British colony. And even though the law that governs the land is Dutch law, which is interesting, and it has consequences of itself, it is very much part of the British Empire.
Another important piece of context, I think, before we launch into the story is just about what was happening in terms of the slave trade and slavery at the time. So this uprising took place in 1823. Can you just put that for us on a timeline of in terms of the abolition of the slave trade?
Absolutely. So the story is centered in 1823 when there is this uprising in Demerara. But this is after the abolition of the slave trade. So in 1807, slave trade was abolished in the British Parliament. And this is what I knew. When I was growing up, I knew about the triangular trade. I was told that Britain abolished slavery. We're the great emancipators. You know, when I was at school, I was never taught about, you know, the British Caribbean and how slavery continued, amazingly enough, after 1807. And it wasn't until 1833, so more than two decades later, that the British Parliament passed the second act, which was to abolish slavery entirely in the British Empire. And that then came into force the following year, August 1834. So in that intervening period, slavery not only continued, but the slave trade continued between colonies. So enslaved men and women and children were still sold from colonies, let's say, like Jamaica or Barbados, and they were transported to colonies like Demerara. Demerara was a relatively new British colony, and the productivity of the sugar plantations was so amazing, and it generated so much growth that the value of enslaved people at auctions was considerably more than other colonies. So there was this this continuation of this disgusting slave trade continued all the way through to the 1830s.
So we will talk about the enslaved people's uprising in a moment. But I'm just intrigued because you said there is, like many people, you hadn't heard of Demerara. You weren't too familiar with the timeline of abolition. So what was your in to this story? How did you end up writing a book on this subject?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say I knew almost nothing about slavery, the Britain's role in the plantations in the Caribbean until I started this research. When I was growing up at school, there was a very passing conversation about the triangular trade. The focus was very much on we, the British people, were the great abolitionists, how proud we are. And what started me on this story was my last book, Legacy, when I was writing about and learning about my mother's family. And I learned that they had a very large tobacco company in the 19th century, and almost certainly they would have used tobacco from plantations worked by enslaved people in both America and Cuba. And so at least part of their wealth came from the slave system, slavery. And I was really shocked and ashamed. And I started looking into this slavery and Britain's role. And that led me to Demerara and the uprising of 1823.
We will return to that contemporary legacy later in the interview, but as you say, to turn to Demerara in 1823, what can you tell us about life in the colony for enslaved people in particular?
So by the 1820s, there were about 90,000 people living in Demerara. There was a European colonist population, about 2,000. There was the same number of mixed race people. There was a small number of indigenous people. We don't know how many, but the vast majority of the population were enslaved, around 70,000 people. Most of them, the majority, had been transported as captives from Africa in that generation. They weren't the descendants of people who had been transported. So they still remembered life in Africa, which is important. And the vast majority worked on plantations along the North Atlantic coast of Demerara. Most of them were now sugar plantations. Previously, there were cotton plantations, there was tobacco plantations. But with the enormous profits to be made from sugar by the mid-1820s, people loved their sugar in Europe, in their tea, in their coffee. It was a growing consumer need. The plantations were typically sugar, and these plantations were barbaric because of how hard it was to grow and cultivate sugar, and then to process it on the plantations. They not only cultivated it in the fields, but then they cut it, and then they then pressed the sugar canes, boiled the sugar, and then transported the sugar and then the molasses in these large barrels called hogsheads. And because of the needs of the process, they had to do it very quickly. So often they would be working through the night, especially on the boiling houses. The conditions were horrific. Some people say life expectancy was as low as 5 years. If you look at these registers, which are still available, if you go to the National Archives in Kew, you can see these large leather-bound volumes, red covers with all the names. I mean, when I saw those, I was really shocked. And the story that I'm writing about is about this one plantation called Success, owned by the politician and trader John Gladstone. And you can see the names there of the individuals and where they're from, how old they are, what their jobs are. Some of them are field hands, some are written down as house servants, some are coopers, as in the case of one of the main characters of this story, Jack Gladstone. He made barrels and hogsheads. And you could see it there in black and white. And somehow seeing that on paper, I found extremely impactful. It was made real. You know, these were real people who endured horrific lives at the hands of the white colonists. They really were mostly almost entirely white colonists. There were some exceptions. There were some mixed-raced owners of the plantations and very few, but still there were cases of black people who owned or had registered slaves in their names.
So you tell the story through the eyes of four of these real characters, two of whom you just mentioned there. How did you choose these four people? And could you run us through them?
Yeah, so I write narrative nonfiction. So everything that I'm writing is true. So to try to tell the story from four people's point of views, it requires an enormous amount of data, of original material. And to do that, I need memoirs, or I need letters, I need accounts that I can quote. Because what I'm really interested in is, for example, dialogue, because dialogue really brings alive a story. And I'm extremely fortunate to have and this is one of the reasons I chose this story, to have the court transcripts. After the uprising, there were these multiple hearings, proceedings, where the colonists prosecuted those who took part in the uprising. And what we have, and these are available in both the National Archive and other sources, we have the court transcripts of both the witnesses used, as well as the prosecutors, the presidents, and we have other sources as well. We have newspaper articles. So I'm able to construct a three-dimensional record of what took place, which hopefully brings the story alive, makes it rich. And it's quite rare, I think, to have a story told from the enslaved person's point of view. That was very important to me for obvious reasons. And these court transcripts allow that. So we have four characters. The main character is Jack Gladstone. He was a cooper. He made barrels and hogsheads on this plantation called Success in Demerara. He was the leader of the uprising. He was born in Demerara. He was in his 20s at the time of the uprising. His father, Kwamana, and he belonged to the local church. And his grandmother, Tonisen, was born in Africa, transported to Demerara by the British. The second character is John Smith. He's a very interesting character. He's a missionary. He's white from Britain. And he finds himself in this situation that he really doesn't like. And remarkably, we have his memoirs. He kept an almost daily diary of what it was like for him and his wife, Jane, in Demerara. And unlike some diaries, it's much more than just notations. It's much more than just, I ate this and this is what happened today. He actually expresses his views and his feelings. And there's an extraordinary record over the many years that he's in Demerara of how their lives change. So that's a remarkable asset to include. The third person we have is John Cheverly. He just turns up in Demerara really by happenstance. His family is quite poor in Britain. He's unemployed. He's desperate to make money. His father back in Britain has lost his farm. He's the eldest son, so he feels a responsibility to make money. And Demerara, he sees an opportunity, like so many people from Britain. And he ends up working as a store clerk. And then later in the story, he's conscripted or enlisted into the militia, which puts down the uprising. And again, extraordinarily, we have his memoir, which has survived. His family kept it and transcribed it. And what is so wonderful for me as a writer from his story is you get to see his response to what happened, his emotional response and his alarm and his disgust in the end at the brutal suppression of the uprising by the British militia. And it really was horrific. And the fourth person is John Gladstone. He is the owner, in inverted commas, of the enslaved people. He's the largest owner of slaves in the colony. He has multiple plantations. He is the father of the future Prime Minister, William Gladstone. And he's also one of the lead voices of the West Indian Association in Britain, which is the association of traders and importers of commodities from West Indies. So he has very much a political role back in Britain. And he was at the center of the fight in Britain to stop the abolition of slavery. And we have letters, we have various biographies written about John Gladstone. We have his speeches in Parliament. And also, gets him to this wonderful, for me, again, as a writer, this spat with this other trader from Liverpool, which is recorded publicly in the newspapers. They have this public exchange of letters and opinions on slavery and the uprising. So again, a very useful record.
And I think that those four characters, they offer you, don't they, a cross-section almost of the types of people that were involved in this event. So through their eyes, what do we see as some of the main factors that led to the uprising in Demerara?
Well, of course, with four characters, we have four points of views. So they don't agree with each other, which makes it more interesting. I mean, Jack Gladstone, his motivation is to abolish slavery. And in the book, I decided to call him an abolitionist, enslaved abolitionist, because I thought that the word rebel or insurrectionist or even protester didn't feel respectful for his agency, for his decision-making. And he very much was a man who was considered and intelligent and wanted to bring about change in the colony, but in a non-violent way. That was very important to him. And for him, the key factors were the horrible conditions in the colony of slavery, the fact that he'd heard of other rebellions in the West Indies. They were very hooked into the network. They'd heard about the Haiti Revolution about 20 years earlier. There was various other rebellions in Jamaica, Barbados, other places, even in the new country of the United States of America. He'd heard about those as well. He would pick that up from newspapers, from his friends who worked in the governor's office or at the docks where he used to go and deliver hogsheads.
So there was a clear ambition with the uprising. It wasn't a kind of organic thing that just mutated. There was a plan, was there?
Yeah, this is one of the interesting things. I assumed, or wrongly at the beginning when I started my research, it was kind of spontaneous. It was almost like an instinctual response. And it turned out, no, this was very considered, very planned. They held off launching the uprising for many weeks, waiting to see if the governor would honor a letter which came from England, which told him to ameliorate, to lessen the horrible conditions of slavery. And when it became totally obvious that that wasn't going to happen, that's when they pulled the trigger. And when they organized the rebellion, they had various meetings about it. It was clear from the very beginning to Jack Gladstone and the others that the only way to succeed was to have a rebellion or an uprising which took place across the colony. The British had a militia which would easily be able to suppress, you know, a few people in one plantation from protesting. But to have something spread across the colony on multiple plantations would be much more difficult for the British militia to stop. And so that took a lot of organizing. It also took a planning and organizing to make sure that it was nonviolent, to decide on the tactics. The tactics were to seize the weapons from the plantation owners and to make sure that the militia and the white plantation owners didn't have access to those weapons. That took planning. It also took quite a lot of effort and coordination. When was this thing going to happen? To make sure it happened at the same time. And they used the context. So there were bells in all the plantations. They would ring a bell, which would be heard on the next door plantation, very much like the beacons, you know, when they lit the beacons in England to alarm people about an invasion. This was the bells, and the sound would go from one plantation to another and very quickly spread. So they were using the local context. They also decided to do it on Monday, when people had at least some rest, hopefully, on the Sunday before. And also any last-minute changes could be communicated, because they would meet in churches across the colony. So they were very careful and smart, I think, and intelligent in their coordination. And you see that when the uprising unfolds in how successful they are to quickly take over the colony and to follow the rules, which was nonviolence.
One of your other characters, as you say, is John Smith, a missionary. Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about the role of religion or preaching. Yeah. You spoke there about church communities in planning and perhaps inciting an uprising.
Yeah, so the church had an ambiguous role in the colonies. Largely, the church were considered slaveholders. Many of the people across the Caribbean who owned slaves, in air quotes, you can't see me putting my air quotes up, were members of the church. They were clergy or higher up. And you see that in the records of the registers of enslavement back in Britain. The church also across the Caribbean, for the most part, saw themselves as upholders of the status quo, which was the white British people having this slave society, and very much saw their role as, again, in quotes, civilizing the enslaved people. There were, however, some dissenters, And for the most part, these were people who were nonconformists. They were not part of the Anglican Church. Today, we might call them Baptists. And the London Missionary Society was the home for many of these people who were anti-slavery. However, when John Smith was sent out to Demerara in 1817, he was told in writing and verbally that he wasn't to cause any trouble, that his role there was to bring the Bible, to bring Christianity to the enslaved people of the colony, but not to upset any of the colonists, not to disrupt what was going on. And when he arrived, he found this a huge conflict. And you see that in his diary. He is incredibly upset by what he sees, what he hears. He has day-to-day contact with the enslaved people. In fact, those are the people he has most contact with. The deacons of his church were enslaved men and women. The people who read the Bible stories were enslaved men and women. So he starts to communicate his disapproval of this, very strong disapproval of the slave society, for example, by reading stories from the Bible. For example, the story of Egypt, where the Hebrews, the Jews, are able to leave. They organize to leave their enslavement in Pharaoh's Egypt. And he reads those kind of stories. And he subtly encourages them to resist the brutality. So, for example, when some of the neighboring plantation owners stop the enslaved people attending service on Sundays, John Smith fights that and encourages them to come, even if it means that they might experience punishment, whether that be whipping or being sent to jail. So he very much does that. However, at the start of the uprising, he's more ambivalent. So when he's asked, what does he think? At first, he tells Kwamana and Jack Gladstone, who were two of the ringleaders of the uprising, look, you should just wait and see. So wait to see what happens. Be patient. It was only after the uprising starts, and we hear this through court testimony, that he says, look, now you've started, you need to continue and finish it off. So he was very much an opponent of slavery. Before the uprising, you could say that he was somebody who supported the enslaved people. During the uprising, his role was more ambivalent. However, when it came to his trial, the powers that be, the plantation owners, very much saw him as an instigator and tried him as very much advocating supporting the uprising, and then found him guilty and sentenced him to death. And so even though looking back in history, we think of him as slightly more ambiguous. And I have to say, reading some of his diaries, there are certainly some racist comments and records that he leaves in there. So from a historical point of view, he's more complicated. But at the time, the planters saw him as very much as supporting the uprising and punished him accordingly.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Those people in the Caribbean who resisted enslavement, they have been forgotten for so long. They need to be remembered for their role, which is why I think they should be also thought of as abolitionists.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
So as you recount in the book, the uprising began on Success Plantation and it spread from there. What can you tell us about its progress and how far it got?
So the uprising started on Success, which was about 20 miles east of the capital, Georgetown. These plantations, if you can imagine, they're very long, thin strips. So about 1/4 mile wide, about 3 miles long. And so they're really close together. So news would travel very quickly from one plantation to another. And people would know each other from one plantation to another. So, for example, John Smith's chapel, Bethel Chapel, people attended for many, many plantations because they were so crammed in together. When the uprising started, when Jack first rang his bell, the news would have spread very quickly. And by the end of that night, more than 30 plantations were taking part. And the abolitionists, the people taking part in the uprising, were traveling away from Georgetown, away from the British militia. They were going east. They would go from one plantation to another, picking up more and more people, so that by the time they got to Bachelor's Adventure a couple of days later, there was more than 4,000 people who were taking part in the uprising in a group. But across the whole colony, you know, there was some disagreement about how many people actually took part in the uprising. The range is anywhere from 10 to 15,000 people, which at the time was the largest slave uprising anywhere in the British Empire. So this was a very significant number of people who took part in the uprising. And by the second day, I think more than 30 plantations were under the control of the enslaved abolitionists. And then in one spot, more than 4,000 people were gathered, and they came face to face with the British militia, who by that time had made it to Bachelor's Adventure.
So how did the whole thing crumble? Why was it not successful?
Ostensibly, the reason why it stopped was the British militia stopped it. So every white person, white man who was in Demerara was obliged to take part in the British militia, part of the suppression. Martial law had been enacted very soon after the uprising had started. The governor sent flyers around the colony saying, you need to enlist with the British militia, you need to join in. And there was a core professional number of soldiers, but these were enlarged by the conscripts. And they went around from plantation to plantation, suppressing what was going on, taking control back of the plantations. And then there was this moment. It was, some people call it a battle, I would call it a massacre, at this one plantation called Bachelor's Adventure, where about 200 or 300 British militia lined up and faced off against about 4,000 of the enslaved abolitionists, who had a handful of guns they'd seized, several cutlasses, but for the most part, they had handmade, homemade weapons. And again, Jack Gladstone, the leader of the uprising, had been very clear that no violence should be used. I mean, not that they could really do much against the British militia. And after a parley where the head of the British militia, Colonel Leahy, went out to talk to Jack Gladstone, and Jack Gladstone said, look, we want to have our freedom. We don't want to be working on the weekends. We want to be treated more fairly. And Colonel Lee, he said, there's no way that's going to happen. And then he marched his men forward, and they're in very close proximity. And he then ordered them to start firing. And within 15 minutes, at least 200, if not more, enslaved abolitionists had been killed. I mean, it was a massacre. It was a bloodbath. It's a real stain on British history, as far as I'm concerned. It's appalling. And it's still remembered in Bachelor's Adventure. Every year, they remember this uprising. They remember this particular, you know, massacre at Bachelor's Adventure. There's a monument there. It was so terrible. And the story is passed down the generations. And then after that, the militia went from plantation to plantation, clearing the enslaved people, arresting them, and holding what could only be described as kangaroo courts. They, after a few seconds of conversation, they would find an enslaved person guilty without any evidence or witnesses, and they would line them up and shoot them. And again, a horrific, horrific stain on British history. So that by the end of August 1823... So this is within a couple of weeks of the start of the uprising, at least 500 people had been killed. After that, there were trials, court-martial trials, and at least 50 people were found guilty and hung. They were hanged in the old parade ground in downtown Georgetown, the capital, and their heads were cut off and put on spikes, and placed both in Georgetown at the entrance to the plantations as a message to the enslaved people across the colony. Again, horrific, horrific scenes, and something to feel really terrible about as a British person and to remember this. And I went to the plantation when I was in Georgetown. I went to this parade ground and we had a moment of remembering some of these people who died, some of these I consider extraordinarily brave people who'd stood up against enslavement and tried to remember what happened there.
Well, that leads us on to the other aspect of your book. So woven throughout your account of the Demerara uprising, there's another thread which follows your own discovery of this story and your visits to Guyana to speak to people about their history and its legacy today. So how was that experience and what kind of perspectives on this aspect of British and Guyanese history did you get from going out there?
So when I started this research, I was really, and I'm embarrassed to say, I really had no idea about British slavery, about Guyana, about uprisings. And so for me, this was really a huge learning curve. And I felt I had to go to Guyana to go to the places that are mentioned in the records about the uprising, to walk the land, and most importantly, to meet people. This history has been written about before, especially in Guyana, and I wanted to speak to people and learn from them, the historians who'd written about it. I was very lucky to meet some of the top historians in Guyana who were very generous and shared their research. Walking across some of these plantations, I was struck not only about how the history is still remembered in the names of the places, names of the streets. There are some memorials in Georgetown. So, for example, what was Murray Street, which was the name of the governor at the time of the uprising, is now Kwamana Street, who was one of the leaders of the rebellion. Some of the street names are named after slaveholders, some of the neighborhoods of Guyana. But more importantly than that, the legacy of the horror is still remembered. So every year there is a ceremony called Maafa, which remembers the tens of thousands of enslaved people who were transported from Africa to Demerara. And I was very fortunate to be invited when I was there to this ceremony, which I found extremely moving. The legacy of slavery was very much real in Guyana. And then when I came back to England and started talking to people, especially in the Black British community, it became very obvious that the legacy of slavery is still very much felt in British society. And this is what I was told, whether it's in the inequalities today in society, in the higher arrest rates, in the, you know, women are five times more likely to die in childbirth if you're Black than if you're white in Britain, you know, whether it's in outcomes, in education, in employment, these legacies are still felt today. And it's such an important history to talk about and to remember. And it's not just Black history, it's white history, it's our history, it's everybody's history in Britain, because the people of Britain benefit enormously from the wealth which came over from enslavement for hundreds of years.
The title of your book is White Debt, and I wonder if you could explain the meaning behind that title.
Yeah, so, I mean, at the time of slavery, the vast, vast majority of people who were involved with and ran the slave societies were white. So the people who owned the ships, who manned the ships, which transported the enslaved people from Africa, the vast, vast majority of people who owned the plantations, who worked in the plantations, or oversaw the supervisors, the managers, were white in the plantation. The vast majority of people who were involved with transporting the commodities, the cotton, the tobacco, the sugar back to Britain, including my family, were white. Not to say the people who benefited of all the wealth and enjoyed the commodities back in Britain were white. And of course, at the center of enslavement is racism. You know, people were enslaved on the basis of their color. That's not to say there weren't countries in Africa, people in Africa, black Africans who were involved. Of course, there were. And countries, for example, like Ghana, the president of Ghana, have apologized for their role in slavery. Again, there were some, very few, mixed race and people of African descent who were involved with the transport and then the plantations themselves. But again, this is a very, very small number of people. The vast majority of those who benefited and worked in the slave society were white. And I think that's important to say that. When I first started writing this book, I was very uncomfortable having this conversation, if I'm honest. But now I realize that it is important to say what it was, because it's still important today, you know, that white people have a special responsibility, a debt for what happened. That's not to say that white people are the only people who are responsible, have a special responsibility. Of course not. But in the same way, when we talk about Black Lives Matter, we're not saying that everybody else's life doesn't matter. We're saying that we should pay special attention to Black people, given the inequalities that exist in society. In the same way, white people have a special responsibility when it comes to enslavement. I believe that white people have a debt to pay.
And if we're to go beyond metaphors when talking about a debt to pay, what to you would that mean in real world terms?
Yeah. So practically, I mean, there's different aspects of that. It's very important to acknowledge what happened. And this is what I'm told. It's very important to say, you know, describe Britain's role in slavery. But we need to go further than that. Acknowledgement's not enough. You know, an apology, recognition, regret, these things are also important. But again, that's not enough. There needs to be something more substantial to that. And now we're talking about reparations. And that can take many forms. It could be cultural reparations. It could be changing the way that we talk about history or teach history in schools. It can be talking about returning artifacts that have been stolen, whether it be from Africa or other countries. And indeed, it could be talking about money. And people, when I was in Guyana, it was very clear that was very much at the center of what they're expecting. And there have been some very, very smart people who've looked at this, and they've looked at it much more than I have. CARICOM, which is the Caribbean community, they have a 10-point plan that they've published about what that might look like. You know, that might include forgiving of debt, or it might be transferring of funds, or it might be transferring of technology. You know, there's different ways of looking at it. And this can happen at many levels, is what I learned. It can happen at the government level, but it can also happen at the corporate level, you know, where some corporations who exist today, who directly benefited from slavery, and some of them have come out now, whether it's Lloyd's of London, Bank of England have talked about this. University of Glasgow have made a commitment to transfer £20 million because they've acknowledged that their organization benefited from money donations that were given by people who made their money from slavery. But it also can work at the family level. And that's something that my family has begun to look at. And it led to some, you know, intense but really interesting conversations.
One of the biggest questions that's always raised about reparations is that people would say, why should people today pay for the crimes of their ancestors? So what would your response to that be?
Yeah, so I asked that. I asked that of many people. And first of all, I should say that, you know, my father's family, we are German Jewish, and we were forced to flee Germany because of the rise of the Nazis. We lost people in the Holocaust. And I have personally received money from the German government. You know, you'd call that reparations maybe, you know. And if I'm receiving money in that situation, I can't see why people who are descended from those who are enslaved by the British wouldn't also similarly. The question then is, how does it work? And that is difficult, you know, who pays? How much, who gets it? You know, these are definitely problems, but these are details as far as I'm concerned. You know, the principle is at stake here. And, you know, we've seen reparations play out in other countries. The Americans, they paid members of the Japanese families who were incarcerated, and it's happened in other countries as well. So I think there is a principle which exists. The question then is, how does it look like? And one question which people ask is, you know, what about recent arrivals? What about people who have just come to Britain? And the answer really is, as a whole, people in Britain have benefited from slavery. You know, HMRC, the tax department, put out a tweet only a few years ago, I think it was 2015, saying that they were only just paying off the debt that they had to take on to pay off all those people who had owned enslaved people, who had been compensated when slavery was abolished. So we have literally been paying this money off until recently as a society. So it's still very much a present concern. And as a society, we need to address, you know, the debt that is owed from this horrific slave society that we ran for. And this was for hundreds of years. This wasn't just for a couple of years. This was for hundreds of years. And this is something that we have to really stand up for, I think.
Mm-hmm. So the uprising, it may not have achieved what it intended to in 1823, but what would you see to be its impact and its legacy? Why was it such a significant moment?
Looking at the newspapers, looking at the letters from the 1820s, looking at the historical accounts, the anti-slavery movement in Britain was really in the doldrums in the early 1820s. It hit a high point around 1807 when the abolition of the slave trade took place. But after that, it lost its momentum. And then what happened was news of the uprising in Demerara hit Britain, and the huge controversy of what had taken place, particularly the trial of John Smith, this white missionary, and then hearing the accounts of the horrific and brutal treatment of the enslaved people. And this conversation was taking place not just in Parliament, where there was a two-day debate, but also across the country in the newspaper articles where the trials were reprinted verbatim, page after page, but also in town meetings. Hundreds of thousands of people signed petitions calling for the abolition of slavery. So the Demerara uprising really re-energized the anti-slavery movement, so that by the time you got into the mid 1820s, it was really a force to be reckoned with, and it was almost inevitable that the abolition took place. And then there was this very intense conversation about how to make it happen, and it was decided, there was this big compromise that was made, that those who inverted commas owned the slaves would be compensated for their assets that they were lost, and that was this huge compromise that was made. And so by 1834, the abolition of slavery bill was enacted, was in force, and on the one hand, hundreds of thousands, I think it was more than 600,000 slave people across the British Empire were emancipated, and on the other side of that, more than 60,000 people who had registered an interest in owning slaves were compensated for that financial loss. Now, for the enslaved people, freedom wasn't immediate. Many of them had to serve apprenticeships for many years. And even then, people would say that the conditions remained exploitative. The whole new economy of indentureship arrived in the Caribbean, brought in, may I say, by this guy, John Gladstone, the same character we talked about earlier. You know, so things didn't dramatically improve immediately. This was the first major step towards freedom. And the Demerara uprising is seen as one of the main triggers of that. There are other uprisings in other colonies. Jamaica, for example, was an important one. But the uprising in Demerara was very much at the center of this shift in fortunes for the enslaved people in the Caribbean. And the abolitionists in Demerara need to be remembered for their role in that. Those people in the Caribbean who resisted enslavement, they have been forgotten for so long. They need to be remembered for their role, which is why I think they should be also thought of as abolitionists.
That was Thomas Harding. His book is White Debt, The Demerara Uprising and Britain's Legacy of Slavery. That's published by Weidenfeld and Nicholson. You can find a link in the show notes. I spoke to Thomas for the January issue of BBC History Magazine, which is on sale now and also includes features on Queen Victoria's spies, British treason trials, Britain in 1921, and a schoolboy prisoner in communist China. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.